Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you. I'm aware that I'm standing between you and another cup of coffee, so we'll try and be quick. Okay, so in this paper and in my overall dissertation research, I ask what perpetuates and sustains the field of practice and the eminently social field of international criminal justice. And we've heard a little bit earlier today about these deep social ties in international criminal justice, so I was very pleased to hear that. So I'm particularly interested in the lived experience for international criminal justice practitioners, those who work in the field, and through their daily work and commitments also work to perpetuate the field. Now, while I do not suggest that there is one sole answer to this broad question, and I certainly don't suggest that I know it or have it, I have spent some time over the past 2 to 3 years attending trials, going to conferences, going to receptions, and so forth, in key sites in The Hague, New York City, Arusha, Sarajevo, and Addis Ababa, in search of the beginnings of an answer, or perhaps, dare I say, the beginnings of a theory. As a PhD candidate in anthropology, hoping to study the field of international criminal justice ethnographically, I've long been fascinated by the social world of international criminal justice, the ways in which many of its experts know each other well, and the close friendships and relationships that work, I propose, to knit the field together. And so even as many in the field speak of the past years as having been crisis years, characterized particularly by those who work at the ICC, as characterized by these failed cases, the threat of state withdrawals, which as of yesterday are no longer a threat, the sense of donor fatigue, and of course, most recently, these problematic revelations about the conduct of the former prosecutor. Now, despite these controversies and crises, there is, however, a powerful momentum to the field of international criminal justice, and we've heard mention of this today. Hundreds of interns continue to flock to The Hague every year. Professionals on temporary contracts lament the lack of job security and steep competition for positions. Even as the two ad hoc tribunals close, we now have a new residual mechanism, as well as a brand new independent, impartial investigative mechanism for Syria. We have private foundations and legal consultancy firms that sprout up all over the world. We have capacity building programs that work to train domestic lawyers and investigators in the work of best practices of international criminal justice. At a recent ICTY Legacy Conference in Sarajevo in June, a senior official of the ICTY remarked with pride that while, I quote, critics and opponents in recent years have pushed against and critiqued the system of international criminal justice, there is now also an equally strong community of international criminal justice experts who would push back. And it is precisely this resilient quality of the community, this quality of collectivity in the social field that has mobilized around the fight against impunity that I wish to probe further. Now, just as an aside slightly before I move on, there's one group that occupies an interesting position, I believe, in the field that may be considered both somewhat inside as well as outside of the collective, and that is a group of defense lawyers. Now, just recently, I watched or rewatched the documentaries War Done Done, which is from 2010, and the much more recent Defending Brother Number 2, which is from 2017. And both of these films follow defense teams practicing before international criminal tribunals, or to be more specific, in these cases, they were hybrid international criminal tribunals, one in Sierra Leone and the other in Cambodia. And so these documentaries follow these lawyers as they work to defend the best interests of their client. And what I found striking is that in both documentaries, these lawyers initially identify as true believers. They profess a fascination for international criminal justice. But after a few years of practice, and this appears most starkly in Defending Brother Number 2, this initial sense of fascination has turned into deep disillusionment, and for some, even prompts a complete departure from the field of international criminal defense work. And so what strikes me about these expressions in these documentaries is that they speak to a commonly felt spirit about the work of international criminal justice that attracts some, but also dispels others. And so that experiential quality is really, in a nutshell, what I hope to probe in this paper, and of course in the chapter to follow. And so I'm interested in the fabric or texture of the field of international criminal justice. What brings it together? What creates adherence? What creates coherence in what is still a deeply experimental field? So what is it that lends momentum to and perpetuates the work of international criminal justice, despite, as well, crisis, scandal, controversy, and disillusionment? In exploring these questions, I've come to find in affect theory a productive analytic through which to organize and approach the swirl of impressions and questions that I point to above. So Kamari Clark, for instance, in a forthcoming book, argues that affects and effective appeals are central to the mobilization of campaigns towards an international rule of law and fight against impunity. And in recent years in the social sciences, we've seen talk of an effective turn. Theorizations of affect generally point to felt intensities. So Brian Massumi writes about felt intensities, or atmospherics, as Kathleen Stewart discusses. And these are felt on a bodily level, and they circulate between bodies in social and collective spaces. Following Labagni, affect offers social theorists an analytic through which to explore the entanglements of the human with the material. Affect, then, is pre-conscious. It is pre-subjective. It moves us somehow. It affects us. And as such, it is distinct from emotion, which is often apprehended or is argued to be apprehended on an individual and subjective level. For Featherstone, affect is, I quote, unstructured, non-conscious experience transmitted between bodies, which has the capacity to create affective resonances below the threshold of articulated meaning. So this reading of affect in relation to international criminal justice produces, I argue, an important insight into understanding the ways in which the field of international justice and international criminal prosecutions are internally structured. And so it are these affects that create the conditions for the field of practice to emerge. As we see in these legalistic discourses, it then allows these claims to operate on a purely rational, objective, and technical level. So in other words, the argument here is that affective sensibilities registered on a bodily level help, in part, to create internal logic and rationality and cultivate adherence to best practices, certain techniques, certain established meanings, in short, the way of doing things in the field. Sarah Ahmed, in her work on affect and emotion, introduces the concept of an affective economy. And in these affective economies, affect circulates to create a sticky coherence with the potential to produce, bind together, and sustain a collective. For Ahmed, emotions do things here. They align communities through the very intensity of their attachment. And it is precisely the inability of affect to be located in one subject or an object, and rather the ways in which it circulates betwixt and between, that allows it to generate the surface of a collective body. And so, in keeping with scholars such as Kamari Clark and our very own Chair Stilona, who have pointed to the role of affect in international criminal justice, I ask what insights we can glean from approaching international criminal justice as a collective body that is also created and sustained by affective intensities operating just beneath the surface, but that make possible the emergence of norms, the emergence of best practices, and the purportedly technical, objective, and rational work of international justice. And so for scholars such as Matthew Hall, Bill Mazzarella, and Anne Stolers, it is the discursive, the aesthetic, the graphic, and the material textures of a field that are central to the examination of affect. And so for the remainder of this presentation, I'd like to focus on an instance of the aesthetic texture in the field of international criminal justice. And so Jacques Rancière in The Ignorant Spectator has alerted us to the political effects of aesthetics. He proposes, I quote, that the fabric of common experience changes the cartography of the thinkable, the perceptible, and the feasible. As such, it allows for new modes of political construction of common objects and new possibilities of collective enunciation. And so I'm interested in exploring the fabric of common experience that lends momentum and coherence to the field of international criminal justice. And I explore then the aesthetic and effective regime that upholds international criminal law's legitimacy, logic, and rational functioning. And in order to do this, I would like to take you back in time, so hence this slide. I'm taking you back to an evening in March 2016. So this is one evening in early 2016. We're back here. I'm walking along Madison Avenue on Manhattan's Upper East Side, looking for a small art gallery. A few weeks prior, I had received an email from the American Bar Association Center for Human Rights, who have an international criminal justice listserv to which I subscribe. And so this was the email, this was the invitation. The subject line on this particular email caught my attention because it read, "Invitation to private showing and reception, art and international justice." Fascinated by the invitation, the linkage here between art and justice, and of course the allure of a private invitation to a private viewing, though presumably hundreds if not thousands subscribe to this mailing list, I RSVP. Now, according to the invitation, the exhibit features, I quote, "portraits of defendants as they stand trial before international tribunals and the ICC for war crimes and crimes against humanity." And it was meant as a preview to a larger two-year project that was titled Weights and Measures by artist Bradley McCullum. Bradley McCullum was the first artist in residence of the Coalition for the International Criminal Court, which in 2014 launched, apparently a rather short-lived, Coalition Arts Initiative to End Impunity. This initiative, I quote, aimed to harness the power of art to enrich understandings of international justice and invigorate the dialogue between human rights, arts communities, and the general public. Its goal is to deepen awareness of the work of the ICC and the coalition's members around the world. And so for about a year, from April 2014 to March 2015, Bradley McCullum, and pictured here with the convener of the CICC, he worked for about a year to develop his exhibit Weights and Measures as he was an artist in residence at the CICC. And so this is a picture of his studio. Okay, so we're back at the gallery in Manhattan. Once I found this art gallery and climbed up the stairs, I entered a small exhibition room with people milling around, the murmur of after-work small talk, and the rather overpowering smell of cheese and open bottles of red wine from the small bar set up in the corner. And on the white walls of the gallery were enormous oil paintings. The first one I see is Thomas Lubangadilo, the first defendant before the International Criminal Court. There he is. His hands are clasped in front of his face. His gaze is focused, appearing to stare right at me. The painting is so detailed that it's almost like a photograph. I can see the redness and a slight yellow tinge in the whites of his eyes. Taking my cue from those who have already gathered, I make my way to the bar for a drink and begin to explore the exhibit. And all on the walls are more oil paintings of familiar faces. At least they are familiar to me, an avid observer of international criminal proceedings. Moving further along the gallery, I encounter at some point Radovan Karadzic. Over there is Jean-Pierre Bemba Gumbo. There is Bosco Ntaganda. There's Charles Taylor. There's Joshua Tsang. And many of the portraits have subtitles: Warlord, Terminator, Nationalist, Defiance, The Butcher, Simba, Child Soldier to Commander. And scattered around the gallery are folders with very brief biographies of these men, listing the charges of their indictments, the current stage of proceedings, and a sentence or two on their occupations or lives before they were indicted. What's striking, however, is that these bios did not discuss whether or when any of these men were acquitted or if the cases were thrown out for lack of evidence. And so they remain in this gallery, the defendants before the court. Now, many of the paintings were displayed in pairs, where one version of the painting is a full-colored photograph, and the other are these black and white photo-negative inversions of the original. And the choice to play with inversion is central to the artist's effort to offer the viewer, as he said, as he argues, a sense of seeing or somehow apprehending the individual's interiority. And so I'll skip over my discussion of the paintings and take you right back to the gallery. So after some time looking at these paintings, drinking wine, making conversation, we gather at one side of the gallery for the opening remarks. And looking around the gallery, I'm struck by just how many of these faces, so the people in the room, not just on the wall, I'm struck by how many of the faces I know and how many people here appear to know each other. I've seen so many of these people before in conferences, at receptions, at the annual Assembly of States parties to the ICC, in places like The Hague, Brussels, New York. There's a sense of boisterous familiarity in the room. Over there is the International Criminal Justice Specialist from Human Rights Watch, and that one works for Amnesty International. And across the room, I see familiar faces from the CICC. The former US Ambassador at Large for War Crimes has the floor, and he welcomes us all to this important event. And he reminisces about his personal experiences in the field, where he often came face to face with individuals who had committed the most heinous of crimes. These encounters shaped him, he argues. And other speakers similarly welcome us and congratulate the artist, and they stress the importance of his work here and his ability to really, I quote, draw us in. They congratulate him on the detailed and remarkably realistic paintings that, I quote, capture the glint in the eyes of these men. And one speaker suggests that perhaps former US President Bush belongs up there as well. There's a murmur of agreement, some laughter, heads nodding, and we all continue to clutch and sip from our wine glasses. Now, there's a lot, of course, that can be said about the paintings and what they communicate and what they represent. But today, I actually want to stop short of that work of deconstruction. And of course, there is excellent critical work on the practices of representation in international criminal justice, and we've heard some of that today. I'm actually interested in the effective intensities that come right before the work of signification and representation. And I'll just show you some more paintings. Okay. So Simon O'Sullivan, who studies visual culture, in his article, The Aesthetics of Affect, prompts us to think about the affects that are produced by art. For Sullivan, affects are the intensive quality, the stuff that goes on beneath, beyond, even parallel to signification. And so signification and representation, this reading of the paintings, is secondary to the experience, the ways in which we are initially moved and affected by art. Indeed, as Sullivan points out, you cannot read affects, you can only experience them. And so with this in mind, I'd like to ask what kind of collective experience was had there in this little gallery by a specially invited group of people working in or interested in international criminal justice. Looking at the paintings, of course, but crucially also being framed in this room and somehow affected by these paintings. We had been invited, we were drinking our wine, we were enjoying an evening with colleagues and friends, and clearly, crucially, we were removed from them up there on the wall, the butcher, the terminator, with the glint in their eyes. Many of us here actually were aligned through shared educational backgrounds, work experience, and presence in the room for a private viewing. And many of us, during the day, during office hours, do the work of deciding who should be up there in the knowledge that it is not us portrayed on these walls, and that it very likely never will be. So those present on that evening had presumably had a pleasant evening, and they perhaps returned home to work the next day a little bit more convinced that their work mattered, hashtag justice matters. And so in this little gallery on Manhattan's Upper East Side, we might suggest that those gathered were affected by the artwork displayed. And perhaps the same can be said of the aesthetic qualities of the buildings of international criminal justice, such as the new permanent premises of the ICC, or the built-for-purpose building of the Arusha branch of the MICT. Or think for a moment of the affectivities in the digital domain, the Twitter hashtag, Justice Matters, and the recent effort back in July to go viral by the ICC with a video campaign on its 15th anniversary. I don't think it worked, but there was a good effort there. So if we agree with Ranchere that aesthetics are political and that they create the fabric of common experience, i.e. what is possible, what is thinkable, what is feasible, I suggest then that there is great value in exploring the nature of the affective aesthetics that buttress and make possible international criminal law's a sense of legitimacy, logic, rationality, and expertise. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.